everyone. I'm now on Patreon. Click the link below. Not only keep the free content coming with tutorials, tips, podcasts, etc., but get a bunch of free stuff like live stream Q&As, copy of my book, voting on topics, behind the scenes, bunch of cool stuff. Click the link down below to join. Hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of the Scott Stokely podcast. And I am still talking about myself in the third person, but it's called the Scott Stokely podcast. I'm not sure how else to say it differently. So we are outside of Moab, Utah. Going to be out here camping for the next 3 weeks out in the desert. If you've never been to Moab, it's the most amazing place in the world. And if you've never done any go off the beaten path, I really, really recommend it. You drive outside of town, you have BLM land, you get on a dirt road, you cruise down a dirt road, you look for a flat area, right? There's no designated campsites. There's no people next to you getting drunk. We're out in the middle of nowhere, away from cell service. It's a great way to just really disconnect. I do this all the time. I find it incredibly valuable. So I just came off a tournament this last weekend, and I played the best 3 consecutive rounds of golf that I've played in years. I averaged 10.29 over 3 rounds, and you know, at 51 years old, without really the time to practice, I mean, my hands are in so many pots right now, with the teaching and then the adventure travel, you know, I don't know if I'll ever have 3 rounds that well in order again. So I was really proud of that. And you know, this podcast is going to be, I said, all over the place. I'm going to be interviewing people most of the time, but also be sitting here talking if I feel inspired. And I started thinking about this because I was really proud of how I shot, but that's not where most of my pride has come from. I'm proud of being good at disc golf. I mean, I'm proud of what I've accomplished. That's not what I'm most proud of, not by a long shot. I did something a few years ago that I was proud of, am proud of, I should say. And I wanted to share this story because there's a lot of information here. So it's not, I mean, some of it's about the stuff I did, but it's more than that. It's going to be about the people and this culture that I found and what I learned about working with them and teaching them, and about this, about a group of people that exist in your town. You might know they're there, but they're basically invisible. And the reason they're invisible is for a pretty good reason for them, which we'll get to in a minute. I'm talking about the special needs community. I say special needs because, well, actually I'll explain exactly why in a minute, but it was autism, but I wanted to expand it to anyone with special needs. So it's not narrowed to just autism. So anyways, I'm gonna tell the story. So the first exposure I had to the special needs community was actually in 1990. I was asked to do a disc golf class at a camp outside of, it was in Northern California. I don't even remember where it was, but outside of Berkeley. And it was a camp for kids with special needs. And I'm not even sure they were even calling it autism back then. If they were, it was a newer term, but that's not the term they talked about in school. They would talk about kids with disabilities or handicaps. I mean, just the words always shift, trying to be respectful to the community, because those words get grabbed and used in derogatory ways. And so that it migrates from that word to the next. It's, you know, no ill intent, but that's just kind of what happened. So at the time it was disabled or handicapped kids. Now we'd call it special needs. And I got asked to go out to do this event. And so a good friend of mine, PDGA number 2002, Victor Malafronte, I reached out to Victor and said, hey, you want to do a special needs disc golf class? Victor said, you know, heck yeah, let's do it. We went out and taught this class. And I would love to say that I was so inspired and moved by it, this became a driving force in my life. I wasn't. I had a good time. I felt good about what I did. I mean, I was proud of going out there and doing it. But I was 21 years old and I was really focused on trying to be a world champion. And, you know, I mean, I was thinking about myself as I actually think you should do it at 21. I mean, there's plenty of time to be unselfish later. 21 is a great time to be selfish. So that's what I did. So that was the only exposure I had to it for several decades. And so then, as I talked about in podcast number one, you know, I took 13 years off from the sport and I came back because at the end of those 13 years doing drugs and a bad divorce and low self-esteem and felt like a horrible person, and disc golf saved my life because people looked up to me and respected me. And, you know, so I found my identity back in disc golf. However, that wasn't complete. I was not complete just doing that. That there had to be more. And I found it in the special needs community. So I was traveling with a woman who had a son, an adult son with autism. And he was not traveling with us. He lived with his grandparents. But I got to see how it affected her. She was a very good, loving mother. But she had been dealt a tough hand. And I realized that it wasn't just him who had been dealt a tough hand. It was his mom. And if he had siblings, it was the siblings who got less attention. And if it was the grandparents, they had to pick up the slack. And it wasn't just one person that was affected by this. It was the entire family. And that's when I started to realize that autism, my first real exposure to it, you know, wasn't about the individual with autism. It was every bit as much about everyone else affected by it. And in some cases, you could even maybe argue that it's the family's more affected by it if a person doesn't have the cognitive ability to recognize that there's something about them that is causing a difficult situation in the family, right? I can't walk in someone else's shoes, but I don't know how it affects the person with this. I don't think any of us can. But for those who aren't, who don't have autism, I can relate at least a little bit to what they were going through. So I and again, I would love to put myself on a pedestal and say that I had these great altruistic motives when I started working with special needs, but I didn't. I was dating someone that I had feelings for, and I wanted to impress her, and I wanted to do something for her. I was inspired by what I saw, but, you know, my motives weren't pure at the beginning. They weren't bad. They weren't either, right? I just was, hey, this woman, I could do something that I think she'll appreciate. And that was what I did. So I decided that I was going to start teaching special needs disc golf classes. Now, the way I did this was, at the time, I was running a business model that I had done years before when I toured, that this is what I knew how to do. So when I came back to the sport, I was doing it again. And what I did was, I was teaching a free disc golf clinic to the local club. I'd advertise on the Facebook page, I'm going to be in town, free 1 hour disc golf clinic. And then afterwards, you play random draw doubles for prizes. The way I made my money with this business model was just a standard model. Everybody pays an entry fee. They get prizes in return at retail value. I paid wholesale for them. There's a margin between wholesale and retail. That's what I made. So it's 100% payback, but I made a profit off the prizes going out. And then I sold some discs. That was my model. And I kept saying to everybody that my clinics are always going to be free. And the reason they're free is because I wanted disc golf to be inclusive, inclusive, inclusive. I kept saying inclusive. It has to be inclusive. Disc golf, I don't want to be ball golf. I want to be inclusive. And I thought I was being inclusive. And I wasn't. I just didn't realize it. Because I was asked at some point, I think it was by my partner. She said, Scott, are your clinics really inclusive? What if someone with autism wants to come? And I don't remember the exact conversation, but I think I responded with, well, it's free. Everyone's welcome. And she said, well, you're teaching like this high level disc golf technique. How does any of that apply to someone, high functioning autism? For sure. They're going to, no problem. But someone with medium or low function, how does this apply to them? How does that include them? Just because it's free, it's not inclusive. And I wanted to argue. I wanted to say, but it's free, it's inclusive. But she was right. It was not inclusive. I was excluding people with autism. So I decided that what I was going to do was, before each of these clinics, if the clinic started at 5, I would just simply advertise at 4 o'clock would be a class for kids or adults with autism. Very quickly after I did that, I realized that as soon as I said it was for people with autism, I was still being exclusive. What about if you're paraplegic, or what if you're blind, or what if you have ADHD? What if you have CP, right? I mean, like, there's lots of things that wasn't included when I said autism. So that's when it became special needs. Although the autism thing stuck from that point on, so I got associated with the autism, but really it's special needs of all kinds. So one of the things that I've learned over the years, because I've started many businesses, if you read my book, and this is not a plug for the book, but if you read my book, I was the first person to go out and do all these different things in disc golf, with touring and events and clinics and all the businesses I've started. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that there's this thing called paralysis by perfection. I didn't come up with that, obviously, right? This is something that I heard it called. But the idea is that you want to do something and you get so wrapped up in the details that you get paralyzed and it doesn't get done. So when I wanted to start doing special needs classes, one of the approaches would have been to start a 501c3, to get an accountant, to name my business, to get it registered, to start keeping receipts, to schedule the events. Of course, I got to now meet with people who teach autism, because what do I know about teaching people with autism or special needs, right? So now I'll have to learn how to work. And next thing you know, I would have been so buried in that, it never would have happened. And I see it all the time. People have these great ideas and they get buried in the details and these great ideas never come to fruition. So my approach is different. My approach is, I'm just going to pull the trigger and then do my best. And it's been a very effective tool. I've built very successful, financially successful businesses on that very model. So what I did was, I simply said at my next clinic that I was advertising, I said, special needs class at 4 p.m., regular clinic is at 5 p.m. That was like 3 weeks away or something. And then I said, all right, now how do I teach people with special needs? I don't have a clue. But it's published, it's advertised, it's happening. I can't change my mind, I can't get cold feet. I have to make it work as best I can. One thing I do want to mention, because this has come up, and this was one of the most frustrating things for me, is that later on, I'll get to this, I ran some actual fundraising. I ran 20 actual, honest-to-God fundraisers back east where we raised money for an organization. But these Blue Power, by the way, I named it Blue Power, these Blue Power events were not fundraisers. Okay, these events were, I was doing a class and doubles afterwards, and it started with, I'm just going to come hour early and do a class for kids and adults with special needs. That was it. When somebody asked me if they could donate money, one of the things I did was I would tell them no. I said, I don't accept donations. Donate to a local autism organization. Don't give me the money, because I feel weak for saying this. But for a while, the haters out there got to me. And so as soon as you think it's a fundraiser, well, where's the money going? Oh, yeah, well, yeah, he's really traveling on the country doing free classes. Yeah, what's in it for him? I mean, these are people that'll just tear you down. The negativity is, it's so gross. But I'm not immune to it. So I wouldn't even accept donations to myself. That way, the money never even, when they made a donation to an organization, the money wouldn't even touch my hands. And that way I could be completely clean. You know, you want to question where the money's going? Well, it's not a fundraiser and the money's being donated locally when someone wants to donate. So poo-poo on you. But it got to me for a while. I eventually got past it. But anyways, so these were not fundraisers. These are free classes for kids with special needs. So I advertised, well, for kids and adults. And I advertised, I'm going to be running an event. And the first event was in Crescent City, California. And no one showed up for the special needs class. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if there was going to be 100 people. I didn't know if it was going to be, I had no clue, but no one showed up. Okay. That was easy. All right. No big deal. The next event was in Arcata, California. And this is one of my favorite disc golf stories. I hope you guys follow this story because it's going to sound awful for a minute. But three people showed up to my class. There was a kid with very low functioning autism. There was a kid who was high functioning autism, and his the person that would work with him was a disc golfer. I can't remember his name, but young, super nice kid. But he was, you know, he was could communicate very well, and he was just more social issues, but it was autism, and blind Mike. So, in addition to the two players with autism, an adult, a 40-ish year old adult. I think 40 to 50 with who was blind, not autism, just blind, came out to the event. He went by the name Blind Mike. Now, I taught the class. I'm sure I didn't do a good job, but they had a good time. No one's complaining. That's the other thing. No one's going to complain when you're trying to do something good, but I'm sure I didn't know what I was doing. But we had fun. In the process, we played three disc golf holes. Where we actually played three holes. Later on, I just set up a basket. We didn't even play holes. But at the time, I didn't know. I played holes. And Blind Mike, I was going to say was, I haven't talked to him in a while, but is a good disc golfer. You know, he threw 300, like the low 300 feet. He had good form. He could only play this one course because on this course, he knew that on hole one, you know, you had to throw to the right, but there was a branch on the right. You had to get under. He knew his course. So he couldn't just go play other courses, but he could play his home course. And he was legit good. The guy could throw. And so we played the first hole. And he throws his shot, and it lands in the circle, like 25 feet away, a little like 250-foot hole. But he's in the circle. We get up to the basket. He says, "Can you ring the chains?" And I walk up, and I ring the chains. And I say, "You're about 20 feet away. Or 25 feet away. And he looks at me. He doesn't look at me, but he turns his head towards me, which was, I didn't understand, but he definitely turned his head at me. I said, "You're 25 feet away." He goes, "Yeah, I can tell." He was triangulating with his ears. He could tell how far away the basket was by the sound of the chains. Blind. So he steps up to his 25 footer. He throws a putt. It hits metal. Doesn't go in. Next hole. Throws it in the circle again, throws his putt in for a two. Next hole, throws his drive in the circle again, hits metal, misses the putt. So he goes par, birdie, par, Blind Mike. So the two kids with autism take off, but Blind Mike, he's part of the local club, he sticks around to play the round afterwards. And so he, it's random draw doubles, and it's the way it works, it's doubles. I got paired up with a new player. He got paired up with one of the better players in town. It's disc golf. He wins. Blind Mike wins. He beats me fair and square. There was no charity. Like him and his partner played well. He beat me. That's all there is to it. So I was like, what am I going to do? I got a post about this. But what do I say about this? How do I tell everybody about Blind Mike? And what I've always been taught and what I've always heard from people with physical, not developmental, but physical disabilities is they want to be treated like everyone else, right? And they don't want to be pampered, and they definitely don't want pity. Never heard someone with a disability say they want pity. I've never heard those words. So I thought, well, I'll just treat them like another man. I'm going to shit all over in social media, and I'm going to rip on him, and I'm going to make fun of him. And I'm going to basically say, screw that guy. He embarrassed me in front of everybody. It was my clinic, and then a blind guy beat me. So I type out this whole thing, and I'm like, as I'm typing it, I'm hearing this voice in my head going, Scott, people aren't going to get this. This is a bad idea. And I was like, so I typed this thing out about how I was embarrassed by this blind guy and how pissed off I was. And I was like, oh, my God, what do I do? Do I post this? And finally, I was like, I don't care if people get it. He's going to get this. He's going to like the fact that I'm not telling him how courageous he is. I'm sure he's sick of that. So I hit post. Next thing you know, unfriend. Unfriend. I get multiple people responding to my post with unfriend. And the best one, honest to God, someone actually wrote, the exact words were, there is a special place in hell for people like you. And I was like, oh, I think this was a bad idea. And then I get a message from one of his friends on Facebook, one of Blind Mike's friends. And he said that Mike thought it was hysterical. He laughed his ass off. And he says, thank you so much for not saying that he was inspirational. He absolutely hates that. So I had to chalk it up to the there's people that think that he wanted pity, and they're wrong, and I was right. He wanted to be treated like a man because he was a man, and so I shit all over him for beating me. Anyways, that was my first introduction to the special needs classes. So, by the way, I have notes down here. That's why I'm checking. So, eventually, the classes, they evolved, and I got better at it over time. And what I started doing was I started realizing that I wasn't teaching disc golf to the people. I wasn't teaching disc golf. By the way, I have a director. So if I look off camera and go, huh, what am I doing? I'm being told to look at the camera. Okay, look at the camera. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay. So, so what I realized is that it wasn't about the person with special needs. I mean, it is sort of, but it's about the entire family. The person with special needs gets a lot of attention, typically more than the other siblings. Out of necessity, it's not a bad thing. It's not wrong, but other siblings can get neglected and feel neglected. And I decided that Blue Power Disc Golf was about the family. And the idea was that I wanted to give the family something to do. So I came up with this idea. I kind of borrowed it a little bit, but the idea, and this is why disc golf is the best sport in the world for people with special needs. I'm sorry, hands down, disc golf is the best sport. It's because disc golf is a parallel sport. Now, I borrowed the term parallel something, like I stole that, but I haven't heard a lot of people talking about parallel sports. Here's why this is important and why disc golf is the best. So the idea is that if you want to go do an outdoor activity like sports with someone with special needs, it's great. If you go out and you want to, say, play tennis, well, you're getting outside, you're getting exercise, you know, like the older brother gets to spend time with the kid brother or kid sister with special needs. There's like, it's a great thing, right? It's a great family activity. You get to bond and all the things that come with that. You do so much. The only thing that you don't do is play tennis. You're not really playing the game. You're playing the game for the person with special needs. There's nothing wrong with this. The challenge is that this is what I figured, is that you have to encourage the older brother in many cases to go out and take the special needs younger brother or younger sister out to go play tennis, because you're not really playing the game. It's fun, but it's not the fun that you get from playing sports. It can't be, right? It is what it is. Parallel sports are different. Parallel sports, you're competing against the course. All right, you go out with someone with special needs to a bowling alley. When it's your turn to bowl, you get to be just as competitive as if you're standing next to a pro bowler. You're playing against the lane, not the person. Darts, archery, golf, disc golf, these are parallel sports. You're playing side by side against the elements. What that means is that with disc golf, when you go out and you play with someone with special needs, is you don't have to change your game to accommodate somebody. You step up onto the tee pad and you throw your best shot with all the fun and enjoyment that comes out of playing the sport of disc golf, and you get to do it with the person with special needs, right? It's parallel, but the idea that, I mean, I was so blown away by this, but there's other parallel sports, right? Well, bowling costs money, golf costs a lot of money, and it's hard. Darts takes a certain skill set. Archery takes another level of skill. disc golf's the best sport in the world for this. It literally is the best sport in the world to play with someone in that situation. It just is. I can't think of it. If you think of a better one, post it in the comments. I can't. So I thought, oh my God, disc golf is the best family activity where families can go out. Not only that, and I'll get to this in a minute, but the disc golf community is the best group of people I've known my entire life. I'll put them up against anybody. Someone with special needs comes out to a disc golf league night, they are welcome with open arms. They're going to get discs. They're going to get probably a bag if they don't have one. They're going to know the player by name. You bring a kid with autism or Down syndrome out to league night on Tuesday. The next Tuesday when you come back out, they're going to know the kid's name. And when they show up, what's up, Dave? Hey, Dave, high five. You know, pre-COVID, right? You know, but like, so it's this community that's welcoming and loving, and it's a parallel sport. I said, oh my God, this is not for people with special needs. It's for the whole family. So that's where this started to evolve. So I started learning about how to teach. Well, how do I teach disc golf? Well, first off, it's adaptive. Okay. One thing I learned right off the bat, that it makes no sense to have a curriculum when you teach. You can't have a curriculum when you teach a special needs class because you don't know who's showing up at what level. The curriculum is, when you show up, I will evaluate your abilities physically and cognitively, and I will adapt the game for you. It's adaptive disc golf. Because the thing is you could literally play a 40-foot hole, and that is a par 3 or a par 4 hole for some people. And when someone steps up at 40 feet and they can throw it 8 feet and then 15 feet and then 9 feet and they drop a putt in, they played a disc golf hole just the same as I do, just the same as you do. They're playing the game. Advance the object towards the goal, complete the goal, measure the steps that it took to get. I mean, that's golf. It is golf. So it's adaptive. I also learned that you can't prepare for uncertainties. You could have a bus full of players who are going to be showing up for an event, and a phone call comes before and says, it ain't happening today. The situation is such that it's so unpredictable. So you can't predict anything. So that's really what it is. It's like you just have to adapt. There is, however, one thing I learned that has applied to just about every special needs player I've ever taught. And I call it the scarecrow technique. What the scarecrow technique is I stand up the players. I get everybody to hold the disc the correct way. And I say, stand like a scarecrow. And everybody knows what a scarecrow is. If they don't, we show them. And you stand like a scarecrow and say, whatever hand the disc is in, that arm is gonna point where it's throwing. It's just a kind of a clever way of saying turn 90 degrees from the target. But as soon as a player does that, I rotate them around until their arm is pointing at the target. And then they go, boom, the disc flies. It heads towards the target. Number one, it doesn't hit anybody because the rule is you have to stand behind the player throwing. Getting hit with the head with the disc is bad. But for someone with special needs, it might derail the entire day, the shock of it. So got to be diligent about that. But you come out and everybody throws. Everybody stands behind, but if they're standing behind, that disc goes towards the target. It also advances towards the target, which means you're making, I thought it said low battery. It says you're advancing towards the target, you're making progress. That's what golf is. So that's really all it is. It's just adapting the game depending on the group. You can also have a bunch of high functioning players come out and you play the course and you're just giving tips. But there is no rule to teaching. The only rule to teaching is tell people you're going to do it and be there when they show up. Teach them how to play. I also found that you got to give out equipment. So I paid for everybody to get a disc when they came out to the Blue Power event. I paid for it out of my own pocket. However, I ran the doubles event afterwards where the money would come in. So the money, I paid for it out of my own pocket with money I earned doing the events that I normally ran. But the people at the event were now coming out to contribute to this special needs class. So it was very symbiotic. So that's what we do. So that's basically how to teach. Now, I wanted to share, I made a couple notes. One of the fun stories that, you know, that happen along the way. This is why people with autism are so much fun. If you haven't had a chance to work in this community, everyone's so unique. Like, there's an expression, which is, if you know one person with autism, you know just one person with autism, right? There is no people with autism this or people with autism that. Sometimes you can say it's common among autism that many people with autism ... but you can't say if you have autism, you're this. Oh, people with autism are so good at math, or people with autism are can't follow social cues. No, it's not true. Some people fit that mold, some people don't. So everyone's very unique. But that uniqueness and that quirkiness is something that I find so enjoyable. It's so exciting. So here's the story, one of my favorite stories. I was at B.B. Owens in Dallas, and a disc golfer comes out. He's in his like mid-20s, and he has a younger brother. I think his name was John. Maybe if I get it wrong, it doesn't matter. But he brings out his brother with autism, John, who's, I believe, about 20. And everybody gets a disc, right? So he gets a disc. And I, by the way, everybody, when I give them discs, I would buy that for them. They weren't rental loaners. I wanted everybody to keep their disc. That way they didn't have any barrier to playing it again, right? So that was very important. I would say if you run an event, you got to give players equipment so they can come back out, or else it's a one-off, which that's not the goal. The goal is to introduce this thing to them that they have as part of their life or their family. So we played the event. And John, who only talked about himself in the third person, so I'm not making fun of him. This is exactly what he said. After we're done, he walks up to me. He says, John had a very good time. John loves frisbee golf. He hands me a disc. And I say, no, John, that disc is yours. You get to keep it and so you can play again. And he says, but John will never play again. And I said, didn't you have fun? John had a great time. John loves frisbee golf. So then keep the disc for next time you play. But John will never play again. John will never play disc golf again the rest of his life. John will never, ever, ever throw a frisbee golf again. Ever. Thank you very much. John had a lot of fun playing frisbee golf and hands me the... And I kept going back and forth with him. And finally his brother has to step in. And his brother says, Scott, I promise you, he had a lot of fun. He really, really enjoyed himself. And he's never going to do it again. He says, that's the way it is. And I said, well, I'll tell you, keep the disc just in case. He goes, okay, Scott, I will keep the disc in case. You know he's never going to play again. But again, it's just that unique interaction. I'm sorry. I would rather hang out with John all day before I hung out with, I'm going to offend someone when I say this, but if you have a nice cookie cutter house in the suburbs, I probably would rather hang out with John.
God, I shouldn't say that. It's horrible.
But I like unique people, and I like different, and that community can be very unique and different. Nothing against the suburbs. Don't send me hate mail. There, I just dated myself. So anyway, so this is what's going on, right? This is how this is happening, and I'm getting better at these events, and people are coming out. Now, a real important thing that was happening at these events is I started getting letters from families, and people were writing me and saying, thank you so much for what you did for my family. People on social media were posting about going, oh, Scott Stokely's such a good guy, such a nice guy. I'm so proud of you, Scott. Hey, you're one of the, everyone should be more like Scott. And I'm getting all these posts, and I'm getting these emails. And I had been told, and I've been told by multiple people, I'm still told by people, that you're not supposed to enjoy that. You're supposed to do everything out of pure altruism. You shouldn't be driven by compliments. You shouldn't be trying to do things where people say how cool you are. You shouldn't be proud of what you did. You should be doing these good things anyways. And I could not disagree more. I'm a firm believer. It does not matter why you do good things. If you go out and do good things, I don't care. I think it's absolutely irrelevant. If somebody's raising money at church, I don't go to church, but if they raise money at church for a family that just lost everything in a fire, and they pass the basket down, and someone throws a $100 bill in there, and their whole purpose for it is so everybody goes, wow, that guy's so nice, he gave $100. I don't give a shit. All I care is that person gave $100 to the people that needed it. If their motivation was a pat on the back, good for you. Pride is a wonderful thing. I think pride is considered a bad thing in some circles, and I think I could not disagree more. So I absolutely, and I have no shame whatsoever in the fact that I did this not just for people with autism and their families. I did this for me. I liked the way it made me feel. I liked the way I felt when people built me up and told me they were proud of me and that they appreciated me. And everything I got out of disc golf, because from people that said, wow, I really look up to you, you throw a disc far, I got it tenfold from people that wrote and said, I can't believe you're doing this. I can't believe you're driving from town to town. By the time I was done, I did 270 cities over 2.5 years. So I can't believe you're doing this. I got so much pleasure out of how good that made me feel. It drove me to keep doing it. If you're doing good things and you're making the world better and you're affecting positive change, if someone shits on that, just distance yourself from those people. Those people are just, they will bring you down. The haters will bring you down every time. Some people just can't wrap their head around the fact that you're doing something good. So that's my, you know, little soapbox thing there, but I got so much out of it. To a point where I'm gonna find this. Actually, I have this back at our RV that is we put in storage because we can't, the brakes. Anyways, I have a book that I printed out, and I wish I had it with me. I would just pull up and show it to you, but I carry this with me. When I left to go on tour this time, I left with a trunk full of stuff. Nothing in that trunk but my golf bag, a suitcase, my laptop. Like literally, like I didn't even have anything in the back seat of the car when I left to go take off tour full time. I just put the trunk. So I carried almost nothing. And I brought with me a book where I printed out 300 letters that I have from people, families with autism, that appreciated what I was doing, not just from the families, but people in the disc golf community that appreciate what I did. And I brought that with me. And it's one of my most cherished possessions, because if I ever, and this hasn't even happened in years, I haven't even cracked that book open, but if I ever get to a point where I was 6 years ago, God, I hope that never happens again. But if I ever start to feel not good about myself, I want to pop open this book and I want to hear someone say, thank you so much for helping my family. And I want to get that good feeling. I want to get that dopamine rush from that. I carry that book with me. And I'll probably carry it with me forever because it matters to me what people say. So that was a little bit of a tangent there, but people shit on you for feeling good about yourself. It's so stupid. So I'm out there doing this. Now I have another story, another, like, this is a feel good story, but this is one of the best ones. This one kills me. But it's one of my fondest memories from doing it. So I'm up at an event. I'm in Northern Ohio, and a player comes out. I met him for the first time, and not older man, but you know, a little younger than me. And he says, "Hey, brought my kid with me. They have ADHD." Now nobody with ADHD had come out, so I thought, "Oh, great." In other words, you have a hyperactive kid that is a medical condition, so the doctors can prescribe Ritalin for you. And I was kind of on that, you know, big pharma kick for a little while, still am a little bit, a lot, you know, the overdiagnosis and the overprescription of medication, right? So that's kind of, that's what I assumed it was going to be, right? My mom told me to never assume. So I was incorrect. This player comes out and she is just walking around in circles, can't stand still. By the way, I got permission to tell this story from them because I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I got permission because I told this one other time on Facebook. So she's walking around, picking up sticks, setting things down. She can't focus. It's actual clinical ADHD. This is what the medication is for. for this person. She's so cool. She's nice. She's funny. She's charming. But boom, 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 just all over the place. So I'm teaching the class and I'm going to teach how to throw. So I said, okay. So I hand her a disc and I say, okay, now just hold on to this. And I hand it to her and she throws it. And I said, okay, no, so hold on. So don't do that. I said, just hold on to it. And I'm going to walk you through some of the steps to throw. So I hand her a disc and she throws it. I was like, she can't even just hold on to the disc and stand still. Literally cannot stand still long enough to do that. And I went, oh, this is interesting. Like, how do I even approach this? You know, again, paralysis by perfection. You don't have to know how to do things. The fun of it is the challenge of adapting. So at one point, we're walking down the fairway, and I hand her a disc, and she goes to throw, and she looks back, and she sees a stick down on the ground. And she picks it up, and she picks it up, and she looks at it, and she goes, this is kind of frowny look on her face, and she puts it down and throws the disc. And I looked at it. Now, I had heard one time that people with ADHD can pay attention in class better when they're doodling. Now, doodling is a bit of a distraction, right? Of course, if you're doodling, it takes a little bit of your mind off what you're listening to, of course. But for someone with ADHD, that's a small distraction. A bigger distraction, a far bigger distraction, is forcing yourself to sit still and not doodling, right? That's what's hard. And so I thought about it and I said, I wonder if that stick is like doodling. And I said, why'd you put that stick down? She says, well, my dad says I can't play with a stick when I throw. And I went, there's no rule against that. She goes, really? I go, yeah, you can hold the stick. So she reaches down, picks up the stick. I hand her the disc. And for the first time, and she's playing with the stick with her hand. She's holding the disc in her hand. And she looks at me and she goes, okay, now what? Now what do I do? And she was paying attention. And I went, oh my God, we're on to something here. And I told her how to throw. We did the scarecrow. By the way, she was ADHD, so I teach scarecrow to everybody. So, but she throws, and then she goes, okay, now what? And I went, oh my God. Like, literally, we just solved the problem of her paying attention when I'm teaching disc golf. So we're walking down the fairway. There's a couple other kids there. And when they're throwing, at one point, she drops to her knees while she's waiting for them and starts playing in the dirt and playing with sticks and stuff. And then she gets the frowny look on her face and she stands back up. And I said, why did you stop? She says, well, my dad says I can't be playing with dirt when people are throwing. I said, there's no rule against that. She goes, really? And I said, yeah. I go, now you want to be out of sight, so you're behind them, and you want to be quiet because you got to be courteous of the players throwing. But yeah, and she said, oh. And so we played some more holes, and every single time they were throwing, she was playing with the dirt, and I would call her name, and she would stand up, and she'd grab a stick, and I'd hand her a disc, and it would be her turn to throw. And all of a sudden, we adapted the game. We basically gave her mind something to do, and then she could focus on playing disc golf. And I was like, that's really cool. That was a pretty good solve. I didn't think much of it, because, I mean, we have a lot of wins at these events, a lot of non-wins. A lot of times, I feel like I haven't gotten through to anybody, and I mean, it it's hit or miss like anything else. So there's other stories where I've taught a class and I feel like I wasn't able to get through to anyone. But this time I did, right? So it was cool. So anyways, they take off and they go on their way. So like a month later, I'm passing back through town and I got to know her dad pretty well, right? So I message her dad and I say, hey, do you and your daughter want to go out to lunch? And he says, well, she can't, but you know, I'll join you. We went to Panera. And so we went and sat at Panera, and he tells me, and he almost has tears in his eyes when he says this. He says, my daughter can disc golf with me now. I've wanted to take her on the disc golf course forever, and she couldn't, it never worked. And now she can play. She wants to join the PDGA and play tournaments. She got a job so she could make money, because I told her she had to pay her own membership. She got a job so she could make money so she could join the PDGA so she could play tournaments, and now she wants to start a disc golf club at her school. And he basically says, but now I have something I can do with my daughter that wasn't working before. And it was just, again, that's not a funny story. This is just a feel-good story. But it was one of those moments where I went, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm like doing something really that I can be really proud of. That was 5 years ago. I texted him as recently as yesterday. We're friends. So I not only did I build a friendship with the man, I don't really talk to his daughter, but it's not appropriate, right? For a grown man to be texting some guy's daughter. But I'm friends with him. And so that's it. We're friends now. And I'm hoping to see him soon. So this is the stuff that happens on the adaptive disc golf. It's super cool. So if you do adaptive disc golf classes, you're going to have experiences like this. I promise. It's going to blow your mind. So the final thing I did was, not the final thing, because I did the events after this, but I actually did, when I was back east, decided to actually run some fundraisers. So when I was in Ithaca, New York, I ran 20 winter series events back east. They were on weekends. They were heavily promoted. These were honest to God actual fundraisers. I forget what percentage of money that we were giving, but you know, every single Monday after the tournament, it was for the Francisca Racker Center, an autism organization in Ithaca, New York, we were raising money for. So every single Monday after the event, myself, the adult with autism that I originally inspired this whole thing, and usually his mom, would go to the Francisca Racker Center. We would hand them cash. You know, it wasn't a lot, but it was, I think, $300-$500 or something. But every Monday we'd show up there and hand them cash. And so those were the actual, like, the only real donations that we did. But it was cool. I mean, that was great. It was fun. These are real events. The one thing I did at these events is that before each of these events, I would talk about autism, you know, and I got to where, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in autism by any stretch, but I feel like I started to become pretty good at, I don't say expert, but I became very knowledgeable of families with autism, right? That was the idea. And what I taught was, I was teaching about the isolation that families face with autism. I think these events were specifically for autism, although the special needs classes are open to anybody, but it kind of went back and forth, autism, special needs. And what I taught when I spoke, I would speak for, I think, 10 minutes before each event, but hey, you paid your money to show up in disc golf, now you get to listen to me talk at you for 10 minutes, but that's why you're here. And so the story that I told was about the isolation families with autism feel. Again, we're generalizing, but they often feel. And I told the story of, let's suppose you want to go to Denny's on Tuesday night with your family. Many families, when they have a child with autism, just don't go, because it can be so unpredictable. That child could have a good day. And I say child, it could be an adult, but it could have a good day, could have a bad day, could do something that's embarrassing, and people stare, people give dirty looks, people are so mean. They can be so mean. Some of it's because people can be mean. Other times they're not mean people, they're just ignorant. But it can be an incredibly, we're out in the desert and someone on a Jeep, a Jeep is going by, not a Jeep, an ATV is going by. This is so cool. All right, so just going to Denny's can be just literally out of the question for that family, because the safest thing you can do is just stay at home. And you get surrounded by people that know about the child with autism. There might be a few other family members or close family friends that understand that child, but that's nothing but pure isolation. That family's isolating from the world. That's why I said earlier, it's often invisible, because you don't see that family at Denny's proportionate to the amount of families that have autism in them, because a high percentage of those families avoid those situations where it might go off the rails. It could become embarrassing and just an awful situation. So they just don't go. And so the example I gave when I talked, and I always like to talk about the things I'm guilty of as well, because I'm not any higher or mightier than anybody else. That's nonsense. So I was just as ignorant as everybody else. But I gave the example You ever seen that kid at Walmart having a meltdown? You know, that kid, that spoiled brat whose parents don't understand how to discipline him properly, or her. You know, those are just rotten parents, right? Who just don't know how to raise a child properly. You know, all they need is a belt, or all they need is more hugs. But whatever it is, like, I could raise. I've been guilty of thinking that before when I've seen that child having a meltdown. What I wasn't aware of is that, yes, it's possible those are just awful parents. Of course it's possible that that is a child lacking discipline. But it's probably just as, or maybe even more likely, that that child having the meltdown has autism. And when you have autism, it's very common to have sensory issues. And sensory issues mean that maybe lights or sounds or even crowds could become extremely high anxiety, bordering on painful. Again, I'm not walking in the shoes, but that's the response that someone with autism might have just to simply having those lights. Well, that person with autism does not have the freedom to leave that environment. I mean, kids don't have the freedom anyways, but especially someone with developmental disabilities might really not have the freedom. So they're in an environment that's difficult, that's maybe even painful. They can't leave that situation, and it's quite possible they don't even have the tools to communicate the pain they're feeling. The only thing they can do is meltdown. Could you imagine how that would be for a parent in that situation? Like, number one, you're dealing with your child in pain, and you can't help them, and you can't console them, and you can't communicate why it's okay. You can't love the pain away from them. But then in addition to that, you get dirty looks, you get dirty comments, you get people who are just plain mean and just lacking compassion. Maybe, again, it could just be out of ignorance. But you get people that are just, can be horrible. So now this horrible situation is double horrible because of the people around. And I've never said anything mean to a parent with a child having a meltdown, but I've thought it, and I probably gave dirty looks, maybe even not meaning to. Like, Jesus Christ, I have to deal with this child yelling. Most selfish thing I've ever done in my life, just about, that I'm thinking about how I have to deal with their yelling when that child is in agonizing pain and that family is going through hell. And I'm worried about how it's affecting me. Like, and again, I'm only saying this from a position of wisdom now. I didn't have that before. I was guilty of making the problem worse. And so I told that story. And I said, that family, by Saturday, is probably having anxiety over their Tuesday grocery store trip. And by the way, don't say you just get the kid in daycare and get him a sitter. You have a special needs family. There's a really good chance. Number one, there's a really good chance that the relationship didn't work. So autism is like an 81% single parent situation. And a low functioning or even average functioning or medium functioning child with autism requires the attention. The person can't even work. So there's none of this bullshit about, well, then why don't they just get a sitter? Like, yeah, that works in the real world. It doesn't work for these families. They're blessed if they have a two-parent household with one person that earns enough money for one parent to stay home. I mean, that is a minority. So they have to drag that child with them to Walmart to go shopping every Tuesday and deal with this. Anyways, so I said, what you need to do is you got to walk up to that family. Just walk up to mom and just say to her, I know it's really hard. I think you're doing a good job. Like, I've done that. Ever since I said to do this, I have done this. I've done this many times. I've had parents cry. I've been hugged simply by just being kind. But again, I'm not higher or mightier than anybody else. I had to learn this, but this is a lesson that I learned from this. So I talked about this at these events. My final thing after I ran these events is that I went out and ran probably another 100 events after this winter series. These were fundraisers. I would give 10% of the money that came. I was making a little bit more money. I gave 10% of the money that came in to the local autism organization. I would actually, because of the haters, I would hand the money to the club president and have them actually donate it direct from the club. just again to make sure that, the haters couldn't say that, you know, where'd the money go? Because like that's what people do. They're awful. Can be awful. But that's where that evolved to. Now, as far as what I'm doing with it now, I don't have the time or the energy that I had to before. I went to 270 cities. I slept in rest areas a lot of nights. I ate at gas stations. I was broke. I spent several years driving around the country. By the way, best time of my life. I loved every minute of it. But I spent several years driving around the country, one blown transmission away from just it all being over. And the anxiety and the stress of trying to do that, I mean, all the positives that came building myself up was wonderful, but I didn't have, like, I couldn't sustain that. I couldn't be broke every day as like a 47-year-old man. So I did 10 events a couple years ago, or 9 of them, PDGA tournaments. Now when I do, not every time, but I've done like in the last month, I've done a couple of people, the clubs asked me to do clinics before tournaments. I say, perfect, make a donation to an autism organization. So I'm still doing those things. I want to participate. Disc golf is going to be in the Special Olympics in Texas coming up. If we don't have a solution to COVID at that point, I will do what I can to raise money for them or try to help, but I can't. I'm distancing and I have to. Our situation is extremely important. That's partially why we're out in the middle of the desert right now. But I'm not done. I'm not done with special needs disc golf. I don't think I'll ever have the energy and time that I had for those 2 years. I mean, I was obsessed, but it'll always be part of my life. I will always contribute to this community. I love these families. I love this community. I'm not done. I don't know where it's going to go, but it's not over. There's more to come. We'll figure it out. So I think I covered everything. Oh, quick shout out. I just want to say MVP was a huge supporter of the Blue Power events. They were just fantastic. They were so good to me. So MVP was a huge supporter. And then at the end, Dynamic Discs, Gateway Discs, they got really behind it. There's other companies and I can't remember them because it's been a couple years. I'm so sorry, guys. But I want to make sure that they get the credit for it. FOSSA Bags. FOSSA Golf Bags. FOSSA was a huge supporter. They were absolutely wonderful. If you want to buy a golf bag from a company that has supported Blue Power Autism events, FOSSA Bags, if they still make them. I don't know. But that's it. So that's... I hope you guys got something out of this. I hope that somebody listening is inspired to run an event and offer a special needs class. And, you know, just there's a community. Like I said, they're basically a secret community. I mean, they're your next door neighbors and you don't even know it because of the isolation that's caused. I can't stress this enough. I did not realize, I knew objectively that this community existed. I didn't really know that it existed until I became immersed in it. And when I did, I realized it's far bigger than we think. And they're the most amazing, strongest people ever. The parents of kids with autism and their siblings are the strongest people I've ever met. Hands down, I've never met their equal. So that's it. I hope this didn't come across too preachy. I get passionate about this and I really hope I inspired, and I hope sharing my failings makes it easier to understand that, like, I'm no better than anybody else, but you can make these changes in yourself too to start making positive change. You don't have to have always felt a certain way to realize at a certain point, oh shit, I can do things differently than I did before. I did, and it works, and it feels really good to do that. All right, thanks, you guys. That's the podcast.